Any question to Idaho?
Yes, Daniel.
I was wondering, you speak a lot about urban agriculture, urban farms. I've been working for many years with slums in Rio. We have today 150 community organizations in Antwerp, empowerment, and several programs. We have never seen the fight for farms. We've never seen people in favelas and slums getting interested in working in agriculture. And I think this is a wonderful thing to have in urban communities.
How you explain it? Why they not?
That's my question. I mean, who are the farmers? How do you this is third generation slum dwellers, because they are totally disconnected from their origin, which is usually rural areas. How do you interest in urban agriculture? Who are the people you work with in poor communities? How do you find them? Who are the urban farmers? That's my question.
Urban farmers are a very diverse group. Sometimes there are farmers who used to live there, and the city just encapsulated these farming communities. They were former peri-urban farmers. But most of them within the city that we are working in are people who are citizens who turned to agriculture because of they fell out of the, let's say, the urban development project and found themselves a livelihood opportunity by starting to farm. Some of them have linkages maybe to family members in the rural areas about where they got their information or technical background from. Others again just took up this farming by, for instance, in Accra, as a migrating to the city from another city and learning from farmers who were already operating there. So it's quite a diverse group. Not of all of them are, even the majority not, it's not coming from the rural areas, migrating from the city. There's a lot of urban poor who turn into agriculture. And most of them are already, you were asking how, where do you find, most of them are already farming in patches in and around the city.
So there's containers are starting to work in agriculture, and then you get them and have technical skills and such. You don't turn anyone into an urban farmer.
Most of the cities, there were different patches where farms were operating. Like I was saying, in the first steps of the joint analysis of the locations of agriculture, one of the important steps is to link up with the farm groups who are already there and get a developer program.
It seems to me that the point that Emma Knight raises is, can you teach people the trade? Can you take people overnight and say, we will teach you to be unoccupied, can we teach you?
Yes.
So one second, there is a few comments. Yeah. Spencer,
Pika, and I have one.
Yes.
We have different experiences. In case of Cuba, also, they had to teach some of the urban residents how to, because 70% urbanization has taken place over a long period of time. And the Ministry of Agriculture set up special extension programs to teach people. For example, all the animal husbandry programs which are run really teaches them not only how to feed them, but how to keep them healthy, how to make sure that they meet certain production norms and so on. And extension workers from the Ministry of Health as well as from agriculture comes in to supervise. In case of Rosario, for example, we have taught people to grow certified organic. So there, not only how to grow, how to compost, how to make vermiculture, how to soak certain weeds and produce. But in that case, the challenge was easy, because after the economic meltdown in 1999-2000, they had chained themselves to the city hall and said, do something for us. So that desperation really allowed, and extension workers were brought together and cities set up an agriculture extension unit. And they come not only with the technical knowledge to get them over the hump. Initially, they come in with a tractor to level the field, make holes to put up fencings and posts, precast posts. There are markets set up. So then, not only teaching, but giving outlets for the production is all set up. So, yes, indeed, in other situations, in Beijing, for example, all major urban centers, metropolitan centers of China, Beijing, Shanghai, Chongqing, which are provincial-level cities with 10 million-plus population, there is a natural turnover which is taking place, heavy migration taking place, but all existing peri-urban farming base, which is there, they want to retain the economic power base because they have connectivity in terms of knowledge, they have outlets in terms of where to sell their produce, they know where from to get the inputs, and the new migrants who are coming are allowed to practically squat and build their shelter and become laborers. So that is, and they know how to farm. So
maybe if I can have Spencer, Lise, and then Rene, if you don't mind, so we will hear some fresh voices, please.
Well, I'm interested in more, more general social norms, social acceptability of urban agriculture in terms of not just the participant in this case, but I mean, what are the challenges in more public acceptance of this kind of activity within the urban setting, and whether you notice across countries there are different factors that might influence whether one city is more likely to see this acceptable in terms of policy making than another city?
It's a very good question. Urban agriculture, until very recently, was not a legitimate land use. It still is not a legitimate land use. When we started working on a global project in Rosario, where it is a very successful program, in Colombo and in Kampala, it was the city of Kampala who took the lead and legalized aquaculture, agriculture, and animal husbandry as a legitimate use or activity in the territory. So that variations are quite pronounced, and we still are afraid of ruralizing the city because this is seen as if we are turning back the city into some pre-industrial or pre-civilized, and this has great link with the colonial project, with the colonial city link which went along throughout. The sun never set. So, agriculture was seen in Kampala. There were signs. You go to Makerere University, signs saying no crop growth. Within the language in the city of Kampala, when somebody misbehaves, people say you are behaving like the KCC, Kampala City Council. Because if the crop was seen by the city of Springfield, they would come and remove it. That which meant that they are behaving like a pig. They would come and remove the crop. But even in the language, the expressions were there. So, yes, you're touching on a very critical issue of acceptance, at what level in terms of legislation and in the social media.
Yeah, please.
This is a Miami observation to Daniel's question. But I think the difficulty with accepting cultivation activities in slums, and I realize there's a difference in the definition of slums here, has to do with the fact that there is a rural poverty memory, at least in our cities. And what has been very important, I think, the fact is that this has become something that's fashionable and accepted by the wealthy. So in Miami, for instance, there has been, on the outskirts of Miami, there have been small groups of boutique and organic farmers who made early connections with California and Alice Waters and that movement, and they have been promoting that in our region for a long time, very quietly, without great success. Eventually, farmers markets of those products moved into the city, closer to the wealthy neighborhoods, closer to the workplace. closer to the poorer neighborhoods. And there was a kind of, that was the cultural marketing. It became more and more acceptable and interesting. And then the people that began the work in the poorer areas of the city were, in fact, somehow educated people who were in the social, ran the community centers, or in some way social programs, who, because they were part of another social group, brought that in. They are, in some ways, master gardeners. They have educated themselves, but they have a master's degree in sociology or something else. And so there's this kind of roundabout route in which it has arrived at the doorstep. And then finally, I think, I wouldn't diminish in our country Michelle Obama's effect, because, you know, all of a sudden it's there.
Instigation. And then,
yeah, just to come back to the question of can you teach and are good examples. I think good examples of working with poor communities who did not do anything on agriculture are, for example, in South Africa, Cape where Emilia has developed a whole process of starting with subsistence farmers and slowly developing them into economic entrepreneurs and agriculture entrepreneurs. There's a good example in Belo Horizonte, where in Brazil, working with communities, small communities. Very good examples indeed are coming from Chicago, New York, where we started to work with communities who never seen tomatoes or peppers, and they started to eventually building those skills, technical skills, and also community skills using agriculture. The challenges of cities, I showed you the socio-economic and more environmental aspects. Most of the barriers that you see in cities are, first of all, planners do not see agriculture as an agricultural activity. And secondly, most of the city inhabitants are afraid of the health impact of agriculture in the city, whether it's livestock or plants. And those are the issues which we have to work with by working with those institutions, linking them to the farmers, and linking them to the opportunities, and but also the challenges and risks that there are, and seeking to raise the management needs. And there are different cities dealing in different ways with them, taking different, let's say, opportunities from the different cities, like I was trying to show providers opportunities, whether Kampala focusing more on food production and waste reduction, or Rosario, which was very much socially oriented, on getting over the economic crisis.
When we talk, and this is something that comes to mind, when we talk about food production and supplies in large, two large cities, we all of a sudden recognize that the notion or the idea of flying tomatoes from El Salvador in the winter to North America start to make economic sense when you tack on each carton $7 for fuel. We will see in other Western nations, be it UK or Canada, other type of food producing structure like vertical farming. Do you think that this is something that we will see? Will it make sense, or we will keep bringing our food from the southern part of the world?
When Michael Pollan was touring around in Europe, this was one of the questions that came up. Can urban agriculture replace rural agriculture? Because that's one of the things that he was saying. You know? Urban production is often complementary to more rural-oriented production. So there will always be products that come from different regions combined with local products.
I believe that one of the questions that comes up, if we will not buy tomatoes from these poor countries, how can we support their economies if we will do it here?
It is not just barter and trade, as I showed initially in one example. It is very cultural. Chinese and Vietnamese put very high value on fresh produce. 70% of fresh produce consumed by the city of Shanghai comes from its peri-urban area. Now, they can follow our model and try to import it, or we as designers, when we export our great designs to these countries, say, gee, this is something quite good. Perhaps you can try to integrate it more durably within your urban systems.
You mean that we are consuming more frozen food, for example?
Because of climate, because of culture, perhaps we have to in Montreal, but there are cities which can produce and which are producing already very large quantities of daily needs of milk, eggs, fresh produce, and even meat, from within 50 to 60. And this is not only in poor countries. In the France, the most urbanized example of France, with Paris as the capital, has more than 23% of land area under forest. It has 40% of land under agriculture. It is producing number one in production of watercress, number two or three in production of decorative flowers like gladiolus and so on. And I can just go on with the list of the. I don't want to overburden. It's just recognition that, yes, indeed, these are important elements, and then multifunctionality of that landscape if you recognize.
In those, in the northern cities, and I count Shanghai or Beijing, because of that, including Paris, how much of that occurs undercover in greenhouses that are for winter growing? In other words, one of the issues is we're all now used to having food at any time of the year. It's not seasonal anymore. So growing it in the north close to the city requires some kind of assistance. How much of that is occurring?
It's evolving constantly, I would say. For example, flower production from Holland is starting to move down into France, which was not widely practiced. Greenhouse growing moves around quite a bit with energy. In Quebec, we have low energy just now. Quebec is one of the biggest greenhouse producers of lettuce and tomatoes. When we go down to Florida in springtime, tomatoes are exported from here down to Florida. They are nice around, they are not the ugly ones. So, we have to look at it, but your point is well taken. We want to eat food out of the season, or before the season. And that is part of being civilized, or being...
And also healthy.
Yeah. If we are become to do some, and this is a question to all of us, we attempting to do some crystal balling here and look into the far future. Do you, we talked about water or sanitation, and what will happen when we will not have as much as water as we do. Do we foresee change in the way we consume and grow our food and bring them to these ever-growing cities? Will we see, say, in Montreal or other European cities, urban agriculture on rooftops? People will grow their food, or it's more or less will stay the same. Are we seeing a dramatic change in food production consumption? Will we tame our needs to buy and eat tomatoes that cost $1.50 in the winter?
It will not be as intense as we architects have been portrayed. It would be more effectively produced like what Elizabeth mentions, just under covers or in large warehouse-type structures. We will certainly...
So this is unavoidable. We will see this agro-structure coming and being developed around cities.
The trade-off is...
But then you create local employment, if you want, like for local farmers who are now in Canada, for example, are not doing anything in the winter. And people say in provinces like us, in Alberta, where we have all this energy, why can't we grow food in the winter? So it might change.
Like Elizabeth was giving, the process of change. Some of these aspects are still in the social marketing phase, and we still have
trying to change mindsets. You see already changes, for instance, in the Netherlands, but also in the cities in the United States. I think it's not only the urban agriculture that's being promoted, but the linkages to rural development or rural innovation. Farmers who try to maintain a farm around the city who cannot cope because they are too small or cannot compete with the larger agricultural firms, they find new markets in the cities, and those linkages are also quite important. So it's not only urban rooftop farming, which you might see, which are already experimented with, but I think in this stage that are merely architects who dream of kind of interesting green buildings by just painting one building green and saying this is how it should work, without thinking how it really should work. But there are already experiments ongoing. I think
so 50 years from now we may see different food production.
Well, if it's not for food production, it might be for capturing water and water harvesting, which is experimented with in various cities, amongst others also in
the reuse of water and energy are two very attractive reasons to at least localize production. And the second reason to do this is if we want to increase sustainability of cities, we have to increase the biomass in urban areas. How are we going to do this? Blue collar workers in industry cannot do it alone. So if we can involve communities in this process, it is a very attractive way. Because if you increase the green space within the metropolitan area beyond 15%, then it becomes a liability to police, to maintain, to continually look after these service areas. But this productive growing involves communities as contributors to this process.
I have with me, before we move on, I have with me two of my students who came to study quickly from other country. I have Rene from Venezuela and Maria from Colombia. Is that common? Is urban agriculture common in Venezuela?
No,
it's not part of the local culture. No. And how is the case in Colombia?
No.
Not there yet. So this is in the same party as Brazil. So way to go.
Well, Bogota is one of the cities we work in, so it's also a matter of connecting. I remember when I came from Zimbabwe 10 years ago, I've seen the patches of maize saying non-cultivation in this area. They said it's all maize everywhere, but the concept was not in my mind, so I just found it a funny concept of maize seeing maize in those areas where it actually was not allowed. So it's also a matter of getting the concept and seeing the culture.
Wonderful. Yes, yes.
Last two comments and then we will move and then we will move to the next.
One of the interesting models of urban agriculture is the cultivation of marijuana, which is highly successful, probably in terms of dollar amount, larger than any of these other things that we're talking about. Originally imported into North America, now substantially grown in North America. Some of it in rural areas in the states, particularly California, Hawaii, and Appalachia, but increasingly grown under lights in urban settings all over America, and in past ones. And so if there's a market there, even if the law is against it, it can still be successful.
When we suggested the house that we designed to go home without any trouble. Here, last final comment.
Talking about specific vegetation, according to seasonal variations, I mean, in Japan, what they have is they like to eat food that is being grown in the area that you're living in. So if you're living in Iwaki, you'll definitely find that Iwaki farmers are then bringing all the fruit and vegetables to you. They're not too keen on having and importing foreign fruits and vegetables. In Harrods, for example, centre of London, you can go in at any time of year and guaranteed you've got almost every single opportunity of finding mangoes in the winter, you've got fresh almonds, whatever you wish for is available. Is this healthy? That's my first question. To have accessibility to all these different varieties out of season
in the wrong climate. Secondly, you just mentioned something about growing the wrong fruits or maize in the wrong environment. Quite recently, in this week's New Scientist, they're talking about how in certain really hot climates, there are trees that were very good for that environment that had been taken aside and the land had been cleared to grow crops, which then killed the nutrients in the fertilizers. So I wonder what your opinions are on firstly climate specific vegetation, and also on how to use that agricultural land for beneficial reasons, and also to keep it for long term use. Not just to think, right, I've got maize plantations, the next 50 years, and after that, the soil is then going to lose all of its nutrition.
Okay, so I don't know if it is a question or a comment.
It was a question.
Yeah.
I don't know if it is. Well, the fact of the matter is that almost that all cultivated land is no longer natural. So if you're growing in the land, you've probably altered it. You're putting boxes over it.
The first time you've got a seed in that.
To eat out of season is an extension of what I would call the spice of life. How far do you push it, or how little of the spices you put in the food, that's the skill of good cuisine.
You can take an Indian out of India, but not the
spice roots and grain of food is as old as the human civilization. So we cannot grow or produce what we want or all we want in places where we are. So it's be autonomous and be self-sufficient goes against this idea. It's good to have mixing. Now, it is exactly like abuse of energy or abuse of this exoticism in food. How far you want to flog it, or how can you plant it in the public. There are two extremes. You can milk it and then just limit it and then enjoy it, or bigger and tasteless strawberries become a way of life 12 months of the year.
Well, just a quick comment. I mean, started, I guess, with your presentation in the picture of the turtle and the changing mindset around the turtle, but hopefully we can change mindsets quicker than that. But that theme has come through all of it, and the idea of changing mindsets around training people to be able to do some of this stuff, perhaps more importantly, changing social norms, acceptability of this, creating the demand in life to buy out the control approach to hopefully finding how to buy it. All of these things are so important as an underpinning of the transformation. So I think it fits very nicely into the concern over education for sustainable development. We are which is not confined to formal education, but in fact it's informal education and non-formal education. Non-formal is how to train in the workplace.
Yes.
Informal is how to change and shape public attitude. So I think it's useful to keep that connection to all these transformations and to perhaps examine what educational environments issues what we've talked about here are how to make it happen.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you once again to the presenter. Thank you very much. And my friendship, we come together.